Welcome to Grumpy Strategists, episode 62. I'm your host, SAA's Michael Shoebridge, and I'm joined for this State of the Union special by SAA's Head of Research, Dr. Marcus Hellyer.
Hello, Michael, and hello to all of our listeners.
Well, Marcus, how are you and where are you?
Where am I? Well, I'm not anywhere. I'm on my way somewhere.
Yes.
I'm not there yet. In fact, I'm racing there. I am racing for the bottom. Racing to the bottom. I look out there and I just look at our public discourse and I see that there is a race to the bottom going on, and I am seriously worried about being left behind.
Yeah, you've got to be part of it. You've got FOMO.
Seriously, I mean, everybody else out there with an opinion is so far ahead of me. We look at Pauline Hanson. I mean, there she is suggesting, intimating that there's no such thing as a good Muslim.
Yes.
I mean, I think Pauline's actually already hit bottom. But
let's not rule out the rest.
Everybody else is sort of listening to this and going, ah, look, it's just Pauline Paulining. Come on. It's just Pauline. Come on. It's just Pauline. What are you going to do about it? Marcus, by the way, she leads the second most popular party in Australia, so we don't want to pick a fight with her.
Because you're not buying in to that old academic trope that somehow having people say highly abhorrent things without any condemnation that matters in the public space devalues public debate and demeans public morality. You're not buying into that old notion.
Well, weirdly, some of the people who haven't really said anything to about Pauline do seem to think words matter.
Who are they?
Well, let's say Premier David Crisafulli of Queensland.
Yep.
has banned certain, quote, terrorist slogans. So if you're listening to this in Queensland, don't dob me into the Queensland cops because I'm going to say the banned words.
Hang on. Just to clarify for legal liability reasons, you are not present in the state of Queensland as you're making these statements.
No, and hopefully there is a carve-out for commentary, but as we'll see later in the ACT, that carve-out doesn't seem to have worked very well. But globalise the intifada.
You can't say that.
You can't say globalise the intifada.
Right.
Okay. And you can't say from the river to the sea.
Right.
Okay. Now, but if you can't say globalise the intifada, can I get up and say the intifada should have an international dimension? I mean, it's the same thing.
Or the struggle should be globalised, because as I understand it, intifada means struggle.
Yeah, so I'm okay as long as I don't use that exact slogan.
Ooh.
So anyway, but this is a living example of when politicians try to sort of micromanage what you can and can't say, it becomes very meaningless.
My in principle position is banning words is not a good thing in a healthy democracy. I'm okay with burning books because, book learning's bad, but banning words, just to me, you end up with a bunch of stupid actions. Like if you want to ban, I don't know, say a picture of Vladimir Putin dressed in a Nazi outfit.
Well, yeah, so coming home here to the ACT,
mm-hmm.
I think many of our listeners have seen this, but some probably haven't, that the Descent Bar.
So and Cafe. Clearly, it's not just a bar. It's
bar
a
and cafe.
Cafe,
but I think from its title, clearly hotbed of leftyism, had pictures in their window of world leaders dressed as Nazis. And these world leaders were Trump, Vance, Musk, Netanyahu, and Putin.
Right.
Yes. So apparently somebody complained about this because they were wearing, Nazi insignia. So Constable Plod turned up, shut the bar down.
Yep.
They didn't just confiscate the pictures, but they shut the bar down and then confiscated the pictures. There was a bit of outrage, but the acting assistant commissioner of the ACT police said, "We're not going to apologise for responding appropriately to racism, hate crimes and anti-Semitic behaviour." Now, is that actually, though,
isn't there a footnote,
an appropriate response?
Isn't there a footnote to the acting police commissioner's statement, which is, no one was arrested and no charges were made?
Well, after a week of intense investigation by the ACT police force, a.k.a. the federal police, who the ACT government subcontracts to police here, they said there's nothing to see here.
Well, you could almost say having someone like Vladimir Putin and Donald Trump and Benjamin Netanyahu and Elon Musk in Nazi uniforms, that could be seen as political satire, couldn't it? I mean, it could. If you were putting it up at, say, a cafe and yes, bar and, called the Dissent Cafe.
And there is a carve-out under the ACT legislation for sort of political speech. Mm. Though you do go, okay, if I'm a Israeli citizen who's a big fan of Benjamin Netanyahu, I mean, conceivably, you could go, I am actually extremely offended.
Yeah, or if you're a Tesla driver and you see Elon Musk in that outfit, you're going to be unhappy. You might want to put a sticker on your Tesla, like a lot of stickers you see. You know, I bought this before Mr. Musk was a fascist. I've seen that sticker.
So,
but theoretically, not in Queensland.
If theoretically, people could legitimately see this as anti-Semitic, to dress Benjamin Netanyahu up in Nazi paraphernalia.
But what about Vladimir, Mr. Putin?
People could be offended by that too.
Yeah. Well, look, I'm hoping, and I'd encourage the acting police commissioner in Canberra to consider this, that plain clothes police will attend at the Dissent Bar and Cafe's live music shows they put on, because who knows what kind of lyrics are being sung at that place. This kind of thing. We've got to take the temperature down.
Well, I see you're quoting our Prime Minister. So from the centre-left, we have been sort of looking at some right-wing, both far-right and centre-right politicians. But, you know, our Prime Minister is a centre-left person. I would argue he is not living by his own words. When he keeps saying, we've got to turn the temperature down,
Come on, everyone.
Yep. But then he says, I have nothing but contempt for ISIS brides.
Yeah.
I think, look, I'm not a big fan of the ISIS brides. I think they did something extremely stupid, noting that at the time, many of them were teenagers. And I think the term coercive control, which is flavour of the month at the moment in domestic violence issues,
might apply to some of those
Yeah. And certainly it's a bit hard to have contempt for the children of those ISIS.
Well, it is. But, you know, to be fair to Mr. Albanese, he hasn't expressed outright contempt for the children. He's just refused to help them and said it's unfortunate that they're in the camps.
It's unfortunate. That these poor old children ended up there.
Because his government won't do anything to help them. I mean, that is unfortunate.
What is interesting is that in 2002, a number of senior ministers in the Albanese government actually dared to voice some compassion and concern for these families who are over there, saying we should bring them back. Now, however, in the race to the bottom, it's like we have nothing but contempt for them.
Well, and none of those Labor MPs, at least one of which was a minister, when they were approached about their comments they made about being compassionate towards these families, none of them would comment on the record because they know their dear leader, our Prime Minister, has nothing but contempt.
Mm.
So he's not turned the temperature down successfully there, I think.
And the alternative government, well, actually, I'm not sure the Liberal Party is the alternative government at this point in time, looking at the polls. But let's just say technically the opposition.
No, I prefer to call it the One Nation Coalition.
So technically the current opposition.
Yeah.
Seem to be proposing legislation that would mean you could prosecute anybody who helps the ISIS brides and their children return to Australia, which seems it's a very Trumpian thing. It's like you propose some legislation that you know will not withstand any scrutiny by the courts, but you put it up there to show, guess what? We're leading in the race to the bottom. But under this, are we saying that if one of these families applied for an Australian passport and an Australian civil servant in the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade issued them an Australian passport so they could return to Australia, are we now going to prosecute
the civil servant? I think logically, given the government's position on this, they would put a defence into the legislation where if an Australian DFAT officer who issued that document also expressed contempt for the Australian he was dealing with.
Or while handing the passport over.
Yeah, so an expression of contempt, I think, would be a defence.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, so that's where I am, Michael. I'm racing to the bottom, but I'm not sure I'm going to win the race to the bottom, but what I am very sure about is we have not yet hit rock bottom. There is still a long way to go.
I think that's a very optimistic thought. We have new depths we can still plumb. And I say that with no hatred in my heart towards plums. So, I was horribly boggled about the Orca submarine $30 billion trial.
Well, as we said, it's giga-boggling.
But I, taking 14 years and spending $30 billion to build submarine construction sheds, that was boggling. But the good news is the government has taken another brave step with AUKUS by spending some more money. Not as boggling an amount, frankly.
It's not much money. It doesn't compare to the $30
billion
for the sheds, but they announced $310 million for long lead items for Snorkus reactors.
Yep.
So money, I guess, going to Rolls-Royce to build some reactors.
Are these long lead in the sense of the long shed, like 420-metre long items?
No, I think long in terms of time, because we're actually, best case, 16 years away from getting the first Australian-made Snorkus. Well, so there is a very long lead-up here.
But shouldn't the sheds be considered long lead items since they're taking 16 years to build? So why don't they just wrap the $310 million long lead into the shed long lead? Anyway, they've announced this new thing.
So what we know is that currently it's taking at least 16 years to build a Snorkus.
Yes.
Okay, if we're buying long lead items today, 2026, according to the government, its own schedule, this is not me saying this, around 2042 is when the first Snorkus will be handed over. So it's taking us 16 years to build a Snorkus.
Well, but it's good to be getting a widget, because Premier Malinowskis said we're spending $30 billion without getting a widget. So here's the government's immediate response. We are buying widgets, damn you.
$310 million on widgets. The best thing about this, however, is according to the government, By securing long lead items now, Australia is ensuring schedule certainty, which is interesting because they haven't actually shared any schedule with us at all, except some very, very top level kind of dates like first boat in 2042. But, actual details around that schedule, the head of the Australian Submarine Agency has basically said, I can't share that with you because we don't own the schedule.
It's the UK.
It's between the British government
and
BAE. So it's not up to me to give you any information about the Snorkel schedule.
I think it would be rude and highly offensive to both the UK government and to BAE. And I would add Rolls-Royce. Rolls-Royce, I don't want to be rude to that fine company, and I certainly don't want to offend our UK AUKUS partners. So I'm right there with Grand Admiral Meade on that. We should not ask any impertinent colonial questions.
Sorry, Grand Admiral, that sounds a bit Nazi to me, Michael. We may have to arrest you.
Well, I did a drive-by of the Australian Submarine Agency, and some of those posters that were on there were pretty compelling, I'll say that.
But anyway, the good news is we are ensuring schedule certainty for a submarine that hasn't actually been designed yet. So that's quite an achievement.
It's remarkable.
Considering we haven't started detailed design yet, to be not only have certainty around the schedule and how we're going to achieve it, that's pretty good.
You know, if you were buying a car and it hadn't been finished being designed yet, and you hadn't built the factories that you were going to build it in, but you bought spark plugs 16 years ahead of time, would that give you schedule certainty?
Apparently it would.
Okay, good.
Now, what is interesting, however, is while it's taking us 16 years to build a Snorkus, there is a country in the world that seems to be building SSNs somewhat faster.
Well, now, I can see what you're doing here. This is an incredible segue to what this episode was going to be about, which is the US president's State of the Union address that he gave last night. Because you and I have been through that for the new news, and that was going to be the focus of this podcast.
No, incorrect. I'm talking about a country that is actually ramping up its SSN production, not just talking about it, and is actually building more SSNs faster. And that People's Republic of China.
Before you get there, let me just close off the State of the Union address.
Oh my God.
2 hours. And I trawled through it for gold because I knew our listeners would want the new insights, but there aren't any. So we'll move on. China.
And yes.
Their submarine. So, yeah, there was a great article, actually. This is Breaking Defense earlier this month. And it said that the Chinese did something mind-boggling. So they have their Chinese submarine shipbuilding yard, BSHIC shipyard. It builds their ballistic missile and their attack submarines. They're mm-hmm. both class of
the nuclear ones, not the conventional ones.
No. Between 2019 and 2022, they expanded their submarine building capacity by constructing a second submarine manufacturing hall and other facilities.
Now, no, it can't be true. You can't build an SSN yard in 3 years, Michael.
But they didn't just build a new shed. They built a new shed and other facilities, and they did it in 3 years. And what is even more interesting is they've been building nuclear submarines in these sheds, and they've
been popping
them out since then. So
you can't do stuff that fast, Michael.
They have ensured schedule certainty by actually producing finished submarines. So here's a very sobering stat for people that think that $30 billion to build sheds taking 16 years before you build submarines is a triumph. Bohai, this yard, is producing nuclear-powered guided missile submarines and SSNs and attack submarines. And the report suggests that 9 Type 93B boats have been launched between 2022 and this year, February 2026. These are submarines equipped with VLSs.
So about two a year.
They built 9 of the Type 93Bs and 2 of the Type 94s, the 7th and 8th Type 94, which is their ballistic missile submarine.
Attack submarines, they're doing over two a year.
Yeah.
About two a year. Yeah. And the US, after billions being injected into their submarine since industrial base, have managed to hit about 1.2
that's right.
a year.
And the Brits are taking 13 years to build a single submarine.
Well, their drumbeat's about one every 3 years. Ooh. Right, so the Chinese are pumping them out at about two a year because they had the gall to build a new shed in about 3 years.
Yeah.
Okay. And the US is still at about 1.2, 1.3.
Yeah. So the PLA Navy is coming from a very low base with nuclear powered submarines. I think they've got about 6 ballistic missile submarines and about 6 nuclear powered attack submarines. But with this, if you can produce 9 between 2022 and now, 9 attack submarines and 2 big ballistic missile submarines, they can rapidly grow their fleet before even Area 1 of the AUKUS production facility down in Adelaide is complete.
Well, it's interesting. So, yes, we can mock, we're mocking, we're scoffing.
No, okay, I'm not mocking. I'm actually pointing out it matters what your adversary can do and is doing, and time matters.
Time does matter. But the interesting question here for me is why? What is going on? Because for a very long time, China really kind of produced nuclear-powered submarines at a very low rate. Mm. You know, they produced untold numbers of conventional submarines. They, for whatever reason, they were not putting the resources into nuclear-powered submarines.
One theory was, well, they're based on Russian designs, but the Chinese can't make them as quietly as even the Russians can, so they're noisy, so they don't see the value, they're expensive, so they're going to compete in other areas. That was one theory.
And I think there's probably something to that. You know, the conventional wisdom is that Chinese nuclear-powered submarines are very loud. So clearly the Chinese now think their technology is good enough, maybe not as good as, you know, leading-edge US and UK technology, but certainly they seem to think it's good enough that it's worth putting the resources into producing these submarines, and they're not going to get sunk as soon as they leave harbour.
And the PLA is still constrained by resources, so there is a proper rationale because they're having to make choices. Yeah.
So certainly, I think you could say they think their submarines have hit a new level
yep.
of technological maturity. But I think the other thing is even if they were the best submarines in the world, you're not going to make them unless you have a clear purpose
yeah.
for them.
And let's not go too far. I mean, AUKUS seems to be an example where we're getting them, but we're not clear about the purpose.
Well, somebody might be clear about the purpose, but that's another thing the government hasn't really shared with us, other than saying they're faster and can go further.
This is interesting because, you know, the Chinese don't give a whole lot of detail about how they intend to use their submarines, but building ballistic missile submarines that are going to be nuclear armed, not just nuclear powered, that seems to fit with their growing nuclear triad, you know, air-launched, sea-launched and ground-launched, mm-hmm. including road mobile nuclear weapons, with their arsenal expanding rapidly. So it sort of fits with that picture of I'm going to just grow my nuclear weapon capability and different ways to deploy it.
Mm-hmm.
But another really interesting thing, I was reading a Chinese military analyst's piece about the PLA Navy Task Force that circumnavigated Australia and were congratulated by Richard Miles and Albanese for doing that because it was so safe and beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
That Chinese military analyst said, well, the primary reason is we wanted to show the Western powers that we could play in their backyard mm-hmm. too. So if they're going to be in our backyard, we're going to be in their backyard and they better get used to it. And it seems to me one rationale for growing the PLA Navy's nuclear submarines, both ballistic and attack submarines, is to get up close and personal to the US. Because, you know, they would love the US to go further down this track of being focused on the Western Hemisphere and the US homeland, and being more threatening and present makes that more true.
Well, if you're talking about your anti-access area denial strategy, so the, you know, A2AD strategy cool. that the Chinese adopted when they clearly were technologically inferior to the US, they didn't have aircraft carriers, you know, they cool. they couldn't stop the US intervening off Taiwan, so they adopted this A2AD strategy. Mm-hmm. So long-range anti-ship ballistic missiles, lots and lots of conventional submarines, which were cheap and cheerful but could, you know, push the US further out to sea. Well, I think you'll look at the Chinese SSNs, and that's pushing the A2AD umbrella even further out, because these submarines, you're not just making life difficult for the US in Guam, no. in the Western Pacific, but you can make life difficult for the US in Hawaii, in the Central Pacific, yep. and theoretically you can make life difficult for the US off San Diego, off yep. San Francisco, yep. off Los Angeles.
Off choke points where they're going to have to come out to deploy their forces. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so that's an interesting strategic development, but it also seems to me to require at least some coherent engagement from Australia and our US and UK partners to say, how does that change the calculation around the pursuit of a small number of exquisite submarines over the next few decades? Because the military balance won't be what we thought it was going to be.
Well, I mean, you can go, well, the US Navy still has roughly 50 SSNs.
Ooh.
The PLA Navy
12 at the moment.
Single digits.
11 coming their way.
You know, yep. so there's a big, big gap there. But we only need to go back, you know, 15 years roughly. And, you know, the Chinese didn't have 10,000-ton destroyers armed with 96 vertical launch cells, didn't have cruisers. Mm. You know, they had pretty much a brown water navy.
They didn't have hundreds of long-range missiles capable of targeting moving vessels at sea like
so,
they do now.
So yeah. in their surface fleet, they've gone from essentially brown water navy to a navy that certainly in the Western Pacific, you know, rivals the US Navy. You know, so I don't think we should be complacent saying a similar thing can't happen in nuclear-powered submarines.
No. Well, they are producing nuclear-powered submarines at a much more rapid rate than the AUKUS partnership is managing in combination.
Yes.
Yep. Now, there's another interesting thing going on in China now.
Let's talk more China. I have to say I'm a bit bored with the US, so, yeah, let's talk more China.
Well, you'll get a good chance to do a sort of State of the Union analysis. I know you really missed getting some meat out of this one from Mr. Trump last night, from Xi Jinping when he opens the National People's Congress on the 5th of March. So maybe he'll be, you know, more of a showman and give us more of a strategy and tell us more new things. So you might get a chance there. But I'm worried about who's going to be listening to Chairman Xi.
Yes, if I was, I would not be showing up there in uniform.
Boy, you can't.
if you're showing up there in a military uniform, chances are you may not be leaving through the front door. You may be escorted out the back door and never be seen
you're
again.
You're referring to the enormous number of purges in the PLA senior military leadership that she's conducted.
It is positively Stalin-esque. I mean, everybody is aware of the famous purge of the leadership of the Red Army on the eve of World War II that left the Red Army without its senior leadership as the Nazis came crashing over the border. Similar scale purge going on in the People's Liberation Army at the moment.
So that there's a great report on this by the China Power Project. It's just out, February 24th, and it says since 2022, so this is 9 years after Xi came to power, he has purged just over 100 senior PLA military leaders, and the largest. So he purged one in 2022, 14 in 2023, 11 in 2024, and then he really got into his stride in 2025. He purged 62. Mm. And as at the 24th of February, he's purged 11 already this year.
So he's on track.
He's on track. So submarine production is up. General officer purges are up. And these are three-star officer and above.
Mm.
And he's also, this doesn't include retired generals who he's also been purging after they retired.
It's interesting you get purged after you've retired.
Yeah, yeah.
don't enjoy that country villa.
You don't get sent off to Brussels in the Chinese system. You get purged. But you could say, okay, well, that's why is he doing that to the PLA? Well, I would just remind people that he's also doing massive purges and disciplinary proceedings across the entire Chinese Communist Party. Remember, that's got about 70 million members. Since he came to power in 2013, he's purged or disciplined about 7 million party members. And again, those purge numbers are increasing in recent years. They're not... It's not, well, when I came to power, I couldn't trust anybody, so I purged all the people who could have been against me and I promoted all my people into power, so now I'm good.
Well, a lot of the military people being purged are people he promoted into senior positions, so that doesn't save you.
Well, there was a great... I'll see if I can find that stat quickly while you're talking, but
what's... It's not just, you know, your random people who are getting purged. If you look at the Central Military Commission, so really the most senior body of the PLA, which Xi Jinping chairs, five of the six military people on that commission are gone. So there's only one left. So it's not just sort of, you know, obscure people. It is the most senior leadership.
Yes. And this was the stat showing he's purging his own people. So... of the 35 three-star generals and admirals that Xi Jinping promoted from 2020 onwards, 32 appear to have been investigated and 29 were subsequently confirmed or potentially purged. So he's really, you're more at risk if Xi promoted you than if you were there before.
Well, maybe he feels more betrayed. But okay, so the big question is why? What is going on? Now, I think, you know, obviously at some level it is about Xi ensuring loyalty. I mean, that's what authoritarian leaders are all about, is ensuring loyalty. But why these people? Like, is it a... I mean, the standard line that is used is it's about corruption.
Yes.
But in a system like that, everybody is corrupt. So, you know, Xi doesn't want to eliminate corruption because the existence of corruption means he can get rid of anybody at any time at his own whim. Yeah. So it's not really about getting rid of corruption.
No, and also if it was about corruption, he'd have to jail some of his closest family members because they're some of the richest people in China, and that wasn't all because they're geniuses who have invented new technologies or industries. Yes.
No, I mean, that is the dynamic of authoritarianism.
Yeah. Well, I mean, part of it is if you want to control a place, making everybody uncertain about their own future puts everybody off guard and keeps you in power, although that can mean that somebody surprising and unpredictable stabs you because they're worried about their future. But,
well, yes, if you go too far where everybody is living in fear, then sooner or later somebody's going to do something about it.
Yeah, someone like Prigozhin drives on Moscow, you know, for example.
So but the other question is, what does this say about the likelihood of Xi taking action against Taiwan?
Does it affect the Davidson window?
Well, so you go, all right, is he getting rid of all of these people because he thinks they're sort of technically incompetent?
Yeah.
And he doesn't think an invasion would work because you got all these hopeless careerists who you know, don't know their job.
Yeah, I promoted you, but it turns out you're a klutz. You know,
yeah, I need people who actually can do it. Or is he getting rid of them because he's going, how committed are you to this invasion of Taiwan concept?
Yeah, you seem to have some doubts.
Whenever I say we're going to do it by, you know, 2027, you go, yes, but my people aren't quite ready. All right, I just need a few more ships or a few more missiles.
Yeah, I'll do my best, but I can't guarantee it. Yeah.
So, well, I mean, the interesting thing I find about this is that the Western commentariat and sinologist community don't really seem to know. I mean, there's a massive purge going on, and there isn't really a consensus view of why it's happening, because our visibility of you know, the internal dynamics of the system is so bad. On the other side, we have the Davidson window, so named after Admiral Davidson,
Phil,
former commander-in-chief of Indo-Pacific Command in the US. You know, he said, oh, well, it's going to happen. It's going to happen between, I think, you know, when he said it was a few years ago now, sort of between 2022 and 2027, you know, that's Xi's window.
Yep.
And that Davidson window just gets repeated again and again and again, as if it's sort of received wisdom handed down from Mount Sinai.
It's an oracle. Yep.
And yet,
what's it based on?
What's it based on? We have no visibility of what's going on inside you know, the Chinese system, and yet people make these prognostications, you know, with absolute sort of certainty.
I've been impressed by there's a really capable guy, writes for Nikkei Asia, you know, a sort of partner paper of the Financial Times, and he spent about 7 years in China, I think mainly in Beijing. And he's been a China and party watcher ever since. And he's quite open in saying, look, I don't know what the purges mean. I don't know whether this means that Xi is now in complete control, will give all the orders, and the PLA will just do what he wants. So he's going to invade Taiwan because he's ready now. Or if this shows the whole thing is in such disarray, it's such a mess, she's desperately trying to clean it up because he knows they're not ready and wants to get ready. And he says, I just don't know. And he and others like him are saying, actually, given the opacity of the Chinese system and the further clampdown on information out of China under Xi, we need to resurrect the old Kremlinology way of doing analysis, which is looking for who hands a wreath over at a party funeral, who isn't there. Whose photo is now not in the party celebration? Who doesn't step out of the car at the resort for the annual retreat? And that's what we're reduced to, and making surmises as a result of that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it does show the limits of our knowledge. You know, so yes, as always, it is. I think it's wise to avoid, you know, thinking you have certainty around what's going to happen.
Yes, yes. Although I would say it's hard to think that the PLA and the Chinese Communist Party are humming like tops when even the people that Xi has personally chosen and promoted since 2020 have been sacked, purged and prosecuted and jailed. So that if I was working for him in a senior role, I wouldn't be going to work feeling happy and confident.
No. But does that, I mean, that certainly doesn't create stability, you know, if that's the environment that people are working in. So,
yeah.
And
Anyway, it's interesting just to contrast the very different insights we get into all the turmoil in America with what's obviously turmoil in China, but the underpinnings are far less clear. All right, Marcus, well, having plumbed new depths, including around Chinese submarine production, I think we'll have to end this episode there. And again, sorry you stayed up late at night to listen to Donald Trump and found such thin gruel.
All right. Thank you, Michael.